KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum, Bitch. It's a noun and a verb as well as a magazine, according to the women who run the Oakland-based quarterly that focuses on gender and pop culture. It's celebrating its 10th year in operation, and we'll talk with the two who run the magazine right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. From humble beginnings a decade ago as a zine with some 300 readers, Bitch Magazine has gone to 47,000 subscribers and is celebrating its 10 years with Bitch Fest, which actually was released just yesterday. It's an anthology of some 54 articles with an introduction by Margaret Cho. The Feminist Quarterly, based in Oakland, critiques sexism in popular culture and focuses on media, TV, movies, books, magazines, the music world, advertising, fashion, and the web. And we're going to be joined this morning by a couple of people who run this operation. Andy Zeisler is co-founder and editorial director of Bitch Magazine. She's co-editor with Lisa Jervis of Bitch Fest, 10 years of cultural criticism from the pages of Bitch Magazine. And we welcome you. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Lisa Jervis with us, who is co-founder and former publisher of Bitch Magazine, is the co-editor with Andy Zeisler of Bitch Fest, 10 years of cultural criticism from the pages of Bitch Magazine. And welcome to you, Lisa Jervis.
Thank you.
Of course, one is immediately struck when, for those who aren't familiar with Bitch Magazine, by the name of the magazine. And I know that you have a kind of explanation. It's like the word queer. You're reclaiming that word and maybe defusing its nastiness and pejorativeness. But I remember a number of years ago I had Elizabeth Wurtzel on, who had written a book called Bitch.
Uh-huh,
was that somewhat the inspiration?
No, actually, Bitch began being published well before her book Bitch came out. So it was a little bit of a, coincidence. Or I mean, she just, you know, happened to choose the same title. And I think that some of the themes about the word bitch that she was picking up on in her book, which the subtitle was In Praise of Difficult Women. So I think that some of the themes about kind of being opinionated and being someone that other people consider difficult are some of the same things that we've picked up on with the word bitch. But I think that otherwise the aesthetic is fairly different.
Well, it was the zeitgeist, no doubt. People talk about this as the B word. They also talk about the F word, meaning feminism often. Now, you've been identified as post-feminists, as third-wave feminists. Some of these categories I know are very elusive. How do you see yourselves?
Well, we've never really cottoned to the word post-feminist because that really implies that feminism has sort of achieved all its goals and, you know, all is right with the world and we can sort of go back to wearing bikinis and being objectified on TV. So we don't really feel that bitch is post-feminist in any way. I mean, we really feel that the word feminism is definitely still a word that has a serious image problem. And my experience, I don't know if Lisa's had the same experience, is that bitch is such common parlance these days that I actually feel that feminist, having the word feminist on the cover, is maybe a tiny bit more off-putting to people than the word bitch.
Well, rap and hip-hop has made some of the sort of more pejorative sides of that. It's made bitch a kind of synonym for woman, really, hasn't it?
In a lot of ways, yes, but I also think, and that usage has sort of trickled down to, you know, teen speak and sort of men calling each other bitches and sort of a more playful yet still somewhat offensive use of the word.
Well, there's a new word called beezy, I think. Have you known that?
That's a new one on me.
It's a mutation of bitch. Well, I get a little bit of the, absorb a little bit of the teen culture now and then. There is a kind of underlay, though, to a lot of your work, which seems to be traditional feminism. I mean, in the sense of critiques, as I said, of gender studies and of sexism and oppression of women, and even getting into some things like capitalist critiques and the like, patriarchy.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that that's, I mean, our subtitle is Feminist Response to Pop Culture, and we've always been very intentional about that. I mean, as Andy was saying, we've never seen the project as a post-feminist one in any way, shape, or form. It's very strongly rooted in what you, you know, kind of refer to as traditional feminism, which in some ways, yes, it is traditional, but it's also ongoing and still, I mean, I think that a lot of the feminist issues that could be termed traditional feminism are still very much with us, and we are, it's always been our mission to address those in the magazine.
I want to talk with you, of course, about pop culture, which is your terrain, but I was reading an article by a woman named Kristen Tillotson. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but she was talking about sexual liberation going too far, and I know that we have a book by Ariel Levy now, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yes.
Talks about young girls having porn stars as role models, and Paris Hilton being a kind of role model. It goes also back to the idea of sexual choice for women, but has it maybe gone in directions that are of concern to you in terms of the popular culture?
Well, absolutely. I think it is of concern, but I would take issue with the notion of that being sexual liberation going too far, because I don't actually think that is sexual liberation. The kinds of images and behaviors that Ariel Levy is critiquing in her book, Female Chauvinist Pigs, which is a really, really fine book, in my opinion.
It's raunchy behavior, really, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes, and she terms it raunch culture also. That's the other thing that she talks about. And that kind of sexuality, as she describes it, and I agree with her, you know, this is my experience too, that it's really sexuality that's about display more than the subject's own pleasure. And so I think that sexual liberation is, you know, is about your own pleasure and feeling like you have a right to it. And this kind of porn stars as role models thing, that's not really about your own pleasure. That's about display for someone else's pleasure. So
what you used to call sex positive feminism then? Is that a brand that feels comfortable, Lisa Palik and people like that?
I think Lisa Palik is great. I have issues with the term sex positive feminism because it implies that that everyone else is somehow sex negative. And I think that unfortunately this debate is really gets very polarized, and the terminology is not nuanced, and a lot of people who do have significant agreement with each other get cast as like these opposite sides, and it's like they have to fight it out between like the people who like sex and the people who don't like sex, and that's really not what it is. It's really a fight between kind of the commercial forces that promote this sexuality as display and the what I would consider more genuine, authentic, liberatory forces of people who, you know, want to teach girls about how to explore their own pleasure and agency around sex.
How about Andy Zeiser, what Erica Jong said, I'd rather have my daughter crash a glass ceiling than a sexual ceiling?
Well, yeah, we could talk about what her daughter has done, I guess, and I don't know if she has cracked the glass ceiling. But, I mean, I think, you know, for traditional feminists, I think when they were talking about sexual liberation for women, they weren't talking about the reality that's happening now, which Ariel Levy really touches on, which is the commercialization of sex. And that's really a logical extension of the commercialization of everything in culture. But it's certainly gotten to a point where, you know, if you sort of look at what young girls and young women see, they don't really see anything, like Lisa said, of value in sexuality if you're not getting sort of outside approval from other people. And it really is about display, and it's less about sexual agency on a personal level. And I think a lot of that has to do also with the kind of cult of celebrity that is so much a part of our society right now, where people feel like nothing you do really matters unless you get some sort of public appreciation for it.
Yeah, I was reading some of the stuff in Bitchfest, and you know, you do concern yourself a lot with the consumer culture and the idea of many of these glamour magazines and how they not only sell glamour cosmetics and all that, but sell the idea that somehow one has to, a woman has to make herself there for a man. And she, what's disturbing is it's kind of trickled down into teen magazines. You know, you read these, you look at these teen magazines, everything's getting a boyfriend and making sure that you do the right things to get a boyfriend. It's really a kind of retro objectification of women, isn't it?
Well, I mean, that's always been true of teen magazines. They've always been very, very boy-focused, and the ones that haven't been haven't, unfortunately, lasted all that long. To me, I think what's really interesting and disturbing is that especially in media like magazines and television, there's a real blurring of the boundaries between adult and teen. And you see that teen stars like Lindsay Lohan and Hilary Duff are on the cover of magazines that they never would have been on the cover of even 10 years ago. You know, they're on the cover of Vogue. They're on the cover of Elle, which are, you know, adult women's magazines. And teen magazines also are really going much further with sort of the cult of celebrity than they ever had. You know, all the aspiration in those magazines, which have always sold aspiration, is now targeted toward really emulating adult celebrities. And that goes for clothing, that goes for boyfriends, that goes for sexuality.
And since you mentioned Vogue, I'm reminded of Anna Wintour. I guess, I mean, Devil Wears Prada, there are certain women that you take off on this magazine, that you have a kind of, I guess, what maybe a little traditional bitchiness toward, in the sense of, Jane Pratt obviously comes to mind.
Yeah.
There's some of that, isn't there? But you, somebody once said, this is a magazine that's not at all snarky.
That's not true.
Yeah, I find that a funny characterization, because we are snarky and we enjoy being snarky, but I think, and our readers enjoy it too, but I think as far as, you know, what you're getting at with, you know, targeting, you know, specific women in the media world, maybe, I think that definitely Jane Pratt is, you know, a target of our ire a lot, although now that she's no longer editing Jane Magazine, you know, not really. But our focus on Jane was really on focus on Jane the magazine, and it's her kind of mode of editing that has conflated those two. I mean, the magazine's called Jane, so it's hard to talk about Jane the magazine without talking about Jane the person. But the reason for that really is that she was someone who was a really important figure for a lot of women our age. And she was the founding editor of Sassy magazine, which was one of those magazines that Andy was referring to earlier, one of those teen magazines that unfortunately didn't last very long, that was not totally focused on boys, that was really interesting and genuine, and a teen magazine that didn't seek to make you feel terrible about yourself as a means to sell you stuff. So, you know, Jane was kind of synonymous.
A pioneer, sort of.
Yes, absolutely. And Jane Pratt was kind of synonymous in many people's minds with Sassy. So when Jane the magazine launched, it was like, oh my God, we're going to have a Sassy for adults. And it was such a, to oversimplify it completely, it was such a sellout magazine, you know, really a magazine that positions itself as like, oh, we're different from other women's magazines. We're not going to make you feel bad about yourself. We're going to be feminist, first of all, and we're going to be, you know, genuine and whatever. And it's so not. So, yes, we do criticize a lot.
You just joined us. We're talking to Lisa Jervis and Andy Zeisler, co-founder and editorial director, in the case of Andy Zeisler, and former publisher of Bitch Magazine. The two co-founders of Bitch Magazine, they have just published Bitch Fest, 10 Years of Cultural Criticism from the Pages of Bitch Magazine. They're located locally here in Oakland. There is the sense that if you talk about pop culture, you're kind of maybe trivializing some of the issues. And I know from reading both of you that you take these issues very seriously. I mean, for example, I was reading an interview you did, Andy, with Deborah Solomon in the New York Times, and you were talking about Veronica Mars and the OC as being more important to kids than reading Ms. Magazine or than talking about public policy or who's running for Congress. And unfortunately, I think what many people, when they talk about the trivialization of this through pop culture, don't realize is how important pop culture really is. That's the bottom line, isn't it?
Well, that's certainly, you know, that's the idea on which we founded Bitch, was that especially for feminists, pop culture is huge because really it's the main way that people form their opinions, especially young people, where they get their ideas about how to be, who to be, you know.
Identity.
What to aspire to. Yeah, identity is very, very increasingly wrapped up in pop culture.
Does it surprise you to know that more Americans know who some of the Seven Dwarfs are than who the names are of the people on the Supreme Court, or know, for that matter, who the Three Stooges are more than they know the three branches of government?
Sadly, that does not surprise me.
And you learn a lot. I mean, for example, you talk about television and you talk about how it's still so moralistic in many ways about issues like abortion, which is, it comes as a surprise to many people. They think that's all gone, you know, with the struggle for choice and all. It's not.
I don't think that anyone would be surprised that television coverage of abortion is moralistic. I mean, the political discourse around abortion is moralistic.
Well, excuse me, by moralistic, I mean like people who have abortion winding up in a car crash and dying like it used to be.
Sure, sure. I mean, if you look at most of, I mean, you know, this issue is particularly, I think, resonant right now. There are huge battles going on around abortion, and the language on both sides is very moralistic. And there are, you know, when people who think abortion should be illegal equate it with murder, I don't think it should surprise anyone that television characters who have abortions are then punished in some way that, you know, punished by plot, essentially. You know, like the car crash kind of thing that you mentioned. Or the most common thing, excuse me, that really happens is the convenient miscarriage. You know, the producers and TV writers want to have a plot where there's this drama around abortion and someone can consider it and they can kind of pay lip service to the idea of choice. But then before the girl goes in for her appointment, you know, she conveniently has this miscarriage. And so they really get to duck the issue, which is kind of frustrating.
Well, in fact, Andy, I think you've said pop culture is more savvy and self-referential than it's ever been.
Oh, it definitely is. But I definitely think it is. I mean, if you look at certain shows where, you know, they reference things like the character having a convenient miscarriage, shows definitely are very pop culture savvy. But unfortunately, there's still a lot of behind the scenes pressure from, you know, family groups, religious groups that really do dictate, and advertisers, of course, that really do dictate what sorts of messages wind up on shows, particularly shows aimed at teens. But, you know, I think also pop culture is very smart. And it's aware sometimes that it's doing these things. And I, you know, actually think that the sort of trend toward pop culture criticism that really is savvy could possibly change these things in the future. But I think there will always be sort of moral pressure to really present the politically advantageous point of view on shows like this.
Position that doesn't tick off the advertisers.
Exactly.
Talk about criticism. Here's something that was in the Washington Post. A lot of people like Bitch Magazine. I'm just curious to get your response to this. Here's somebody bitching about Bitch Magazine, as it were. The editors of Bitch Magazine put out a great T-shirt. Washington Post writer says, it says, bitch, it's a noun, it's a verb, it's a magazine. Unfortunately, the magazine is not as witty. It's subtitled Feminist Response to Pop Culture. In the current issue, there are essays on such pop phenomena as cosmetic surgery, feminist rhetoric, and advertising in TV sitcoms. Just Shoot Me and Veronica's Closet. Those shows are said to, quote, offer a myriad of elements that comprise a piecemeal critique of women and representation, whatever that means. Not all the prose is that bad. Some is even worse. A review of a fashion magazine aimed at large women actually contains the phrase, a potent tool of the capitalist patriarchy. Yikes, he says. And you say?
Well, I think that piece of criticism is clearly written from a place that's kind of hostile to, I would say, the discipline of women's studies, where a lot of that language comes from, you know, kind of the academic study of gender and its ramifications. And I think, I mean, also...
Well, you are somewhat academic.
Yes, we absolutely are, you know, and something that we really love to do is kind of translate academic ideas into less jargony, more snappy prose. And, you know, reading that quote, I mean, I'm not going to disagree that some of that language is clunky. And I also, given the topics that are referenced there, like that's from, I believe, 1998 or so.
I actually remember when that review came out.
Because we track what people are saying about
us.
We're very sensitive.
Well, they are saying good things as well. And I think it needs to be said here that you have sort of been striving for some time to find what you've described as more gently friendly places in the media where women are concerned. I mean, where are those to be found, for example, especially in the mass media, or are they to be found?
I think they're somewhat rarely to be found in the mass media, but I think what we've chosen to highlight tends to be pop culture and media that is a little bit under the radar, and this tends to be, you know, independent film and books, independent music, and, you know, things that really take on a critique of the mass media as they define themselves against it.
I'm sure you heard this argument, though. You have all these strong women in film now, you know, the Angelina Jolie characters who go out, or the Charlie Angels, you know, who go out and beat the hell out of men and everybody else. They come across whoever their adversaries are. And you also have this argument that now you have strong women on television, you know, Special Victims Unit, Mariska Hargitay and so forth. And doesn't this seem to be a sea change or a quantum change from 10, 15 years ago?
I think it's a very positive development. I mean, I think there is on dramatic series on TV and in action movies, there has certainly been a huge change in the roles available to women. And I think that's really heartening. I mean, when we started the magazine, and this was a kind of a particular pet peeve of mine because I really like action movies. I like to watch things explode. That's my dirty little secret. The only roles available to women were as kind of the girlfriend, and they were always just like, oh, honey, please come home safely after you save the world, you know, after you catch that bad guy. And now, as you know, there are Charlie's Angels, Angelina Jolie, there are all these other, I actually wrote an article for another magazine called Lip on the phenomenon of the ass-kicking babe, and about those women. And I think that sometimes it's frustrating because it is kind of about their sexual display as they do this ass kicking, but it's a lot better that they're out there being active. You know, I think in the realm of comedy, we haven't seen nearly as much progress in women's roles. In
Will and Grace, shows like that, that's not progress?
Well, it may be progress from a queer visibility perspective. I'm not going to argue for Grace as like any kind of progress for women. I mean, she's kind of this neurotic airhead who mostly cares about finding her next boyfriend.
But I was watching one of those shows recently, and I was surprised. Again, it's the sexuality surprised me. She was talking about all the men, you know, counting the men that she'd had relations with, and, you know, it was considerably larger in number than her male friends. In fact, it exceeded by big numbers than her male friends, which seemed to me something you couldn't have done 10 years ago in a sitcom.
That's probably true, but I also question whether that's really progress or whether that's just sort of the kind of titillation and display that Ariel Levy is talking about on a smaller scale. I think also,
or maybe lip service of some sort.
Well, possibly, yeah. I think also that, you know, I am definitely all for, you know, the ass-kicking babes and the action movies and the women on shows like CSI and Law & Order. I love them. But I think the danger there is that when the mainstream media talks about feminism more and more these days, they're actually not looking at actual women and what they're doing. They're looking at fictional characters.
Cartoons, maybe.
Even, yeah. Mm. And you know, so my sense is I don't want the mainstream media saying that, oh, you know, we have strong women in movies. That's enough. What more do you feminists want? You know, when really there's so much left to do in a real world sense that's getting completely overlooked when people talk in the mainstream media about feminism.
The irony is there are a lot of feminists in Hollywood. I mean, I'm thinking about people like Sherry Lansing, you know, who is pretty much has her bona fides as a feminist and running one of the biggest studios in Hollywood. Not anymore, but was for quite some time, and yet don't necessarily appear to be as responsive to giving women the kind of roles I think that both of you would like to see women have, you know?
Well, here's the thing. Unfortunately, I mean, it's not necessarily about the decisions that individual women, when there are so few of them, individual feminists in positions of power, are really limited in what they can do. I mean, Hollywood is a system, you know, and it produces things that are kind of tried and true as far as what makes money. You know, and so making change in that system is a lot harder than just one person. You know, and something, I think that's something that Bitch has really tried to tackle as far as not just analyzing these individual images, but really making connections with the commercial forces that determine what the representations are and what that means for women's real lives.
Well, we're talking about the ongoing evolution of feminist thought here with the founders of Bitch Magazine. Their collection, Bitch Fest, 10 Years of Cultural Criticism from the Pages of Bitch Magazine, was released just yesterday. You can join us, and we invite you to join us. How do you think women are portrayed in the media, in any aspect of the media, and your thoughts on that whole subject that we're dealing with this hour? Toll-free number, 866-733-6786. That'll work whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or satellite. It's 866-733-6786. Or our email address is forum@kqed.org. We welcome your calls. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Andy Zeisler and Lisa Jervis. They are, in fact, the founders, the co-founders of Bitch Magazine, which is out of Oakland here in the Bay Area, and their collection, Bitch Fest, 10 Years of Cultural Criticism from the Pages of Bitch Magazine, was released just yesterday, and they are having a birthday bash to celebrate their 10 years. And if you are interested, it's tonight in San Francisco over at the Rickshaw Shop on 155 Fell Street and begins at 7:30. And the tickets are $15, which you can get presumably at the door. It's a fundraiser. And we're going to go to your phone calls. And let's begin with Gene. Good morning. Gene?
Jean.
Yes, Jean. That's what I thought I said.
Hi. Yeah. Hi. Good morning. I just wanted to say congratulations to both of your guests, and just what a wonderful 10 years it's been. And I was actually an early subscriber in the first year of the magazine, and even had it sent abroad. So I bought a subscription for my mother-in-law, as a matter of fact. So I'm really delighted to see that you're still out there and putting interesting feminist just commentary about popular culture out there. My question is sort of, I've sort of grown up in my feminist thought through the magazine and also through my own life, my academic life, and also personal life. And I just wanted to hear about how you've changed or what sort of remained the same, what your evolution has been in the last 10 years. You know, that's my question.
It's probably a big question, but some impressions about how 10 years of being at the helm of Bitch have changed you or changed either of you?
As an organization or personally?
I think she's asking personally, weren't you, Jean?
Yeah, I think I am personally.
I feel a lot more maybe entitled to my opinions because I have an organization
What about your feminist
me.
Thinking?
I think my feminist thinking has probably evolved a little bit. You know, I think my biggest influences when I was in college and slightly beyond were really the radical feminists of the second wave, like Shulamith Firestone, Robin Morgan, Ellen Willis. And I definitely am still incredibly interested in what all those women have to say, and I reread their books. But I think there's also room for a feminism that is a little more accommodating. And partly because I really want pop culture to reflect feminism, I think there's a way in which feminism also has to be very conscious of, dismantling the master's house with the master's tools. And often that comes with sort of sneaking feminist content into mainstream places.
Well, the three you mentioned have sort of become less militant through the years. In fact, we had Robin Morgan on when she did her memoir, and I've been reading a little Shulamith Firestone through the years. It seems, certainly a lot of that was a rhetoric of the 60s, a rhetoric of the movement and changing the world and so forth. So it's been at least toned down to some extent, which reminds me, somebody had said some very good things about Bitch magazine, but said they don't deal enough with aging, which should be a central issue to women. Is that a fair criticism?
I think when we first started, we were much more a zine, and thus we weren't really, we didn't have as much of a balance of issues as we do now. And because Lisa and I were so young when we started it, dealing with aging just wasn't really on our minds or on our agenda.
But is it now, though?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think maybe that's part of it, too. As
you evolve?
as we age.
Yeah, one hopes the two are in sync.
Those issues are definitely more at the fore. And I think, you know, culturally, the issue of women aging and the sort of political and health ramifications of that are much more at the fore.
And at the fore is our next caller, Bianca. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm a mom in Piedmont in California, and I have four daughters. And I'm very concerned because I just see that everything that, you know, like you were talking about Veronica Mars and, you know, OC, that the kids are really attracted to all that stuff. Like my little kids, I have a 9-year-old daughter. She knows who Sarah Jessica Parker is from Sex and the City. And we go to the, supermarket checkout line. She goes, look, Mom, there's, you know, with a girl from Sex. And it's like, how do they even know about that? And I'm just very concerned because they're so attracted to this pop culture that seems to be defining for them who they need to be and who they are. And I'm particularly interested in any suggestions you might have for magazines that will be alternative to People and Teen Vogue and, you know, that kind of stuff.
The celebrity culture again.
Yes, yeah. What's out there that's an alternative for our kids, and how do we encourage that, and how do we, you know, because I'm really struggling with that.
Other than, you know, evangelical living or something like that.
Right, exactly. I'm not at all interested in that. I mean, I listen to NPR every day, and I went to Berkeley. I don't consider myself, and it's interesting the way that you were talking about feminism, because I'm a 40-year-old woman, and I don't consider myself to be a feminist. But as I watch my children mature and my daughters you know, want to wear clothes that show their bellies and those kinds of things, I'm finding myself becoming more and more conservative, and radically so. Like, you know, there's nothing that's powerful to me about, you know, showing your body in a way that is not, that's objectified. That to me just is not what I want to see in my children, and not what I want to see reflected back to them, saying to them that that's how they're valued.
Tell us some thoughts about places maybe that she can go, that Bianca can go. Lisa Jervis?
I have two magazine suggestions for you. One is there's a magazine out of Minnesota called New Moon, and it's for younger girls, probably 7 to 10, 11, I think. And it has a lot of girl-produced content, and it's really a very strong antidote to those other magazines. There's also a similar magazine called Teen Voices, which, again, is all produced by teens for teens with, you know, some adult staff supervision, but, you know, it's teen produced, and that's for, you know, kind of, you can grow out of New Moon into Teen Voices. So I would definitely suggest checking out those two. And also, I think just, you know, I mean, I'm not a parent or an educator, so I should, you know, caveats with that, but I think there's no way to shield your kids from the kinds of media that you're talking about. And, you know, as Bianca pointed out, you know, the kids are really attracted to that stuff, and they're going to find out about it, you know, no matter what. They're going to be consuming it. But you can critically engage with that stuff with your children and talk to them about it and talk about how it makes you feel and what's wrong with it, and encourage them to think and talk about what might be wrong with it and how it makes them feel. And, you know, you can really equip them with the tools of critical analysis that they're going to need in order to not be damaged by all these messages. Because there's no way, I mean, we live in this intensely mediated world. There's commercial messages everywhere. You can't avoid them, but kids need the tools to deal with it.
That's excellent advice. Good luck to you, Bianca. With four teenage daughters soon to be, you'll need it. And thank you.
Thank you very much. And how do we get a subscription to your magazine?
You can go on our website, which is www.bitchmagazine.com.
Thank you again, Bianca. And we'll go to more calls in just a moment. But since you mentioned Sex and the City, what about the Kim Cattrall character? You know, there's some who say, again, pushing the envelope in terms of sexuality, making her characteristically what men had always been, kind of a sexual predator almost, really.
I personally, on the one hand, I really appreciated her character. And, you know, I'm not going to be ashamed to admit on the radio that there are a lot of things about her that I really related to, you know. And her behavior, I think, is not as much an outlier in terms of how women behave as people often think, you know. But I think it's unfortunate that she was really a caricature. She was the most thinly drawn character of the four on Sex and the City. And that always really disappointed me, you know, that she couldn't be this kind of highly sexual, libidinous pursuer character and also have some of the depth that was written into some of the other characters.
Well, they tried that later on. She really evolved the least of all four of them. There was also the old saw that the character had been invented by gay men, and one wondered about, there were some, you know, some silly jokes about that and so forth, but in other words, her sexuality and her desire to be shopping a lot and all that sort of thing, it was suggested somehow came from the minds or imaginations of gay men.
I actually have a friend who wrote for the, who not wrote for the show, but who worked on the show, and he actually did vouch for the fact that she was largely a creation of the gay male writers and producers. But that said, I don't really think that's a fair characterization to say that that's all she was, because that's basically saying that, it's an unfortunate stereotype of gay men, but it's also really taking away the idea that a woman really could behave like that. And I think that's a really, I mean, I think Samantha's a really important character, as Lisa was saying, because I think she really does. More women, she was sort of played for a joke, but I think more women than they expected really did relate to her and really, you know, felt her sort of outrage when she was chastised for her behavior, or whether when it was suggested that really she was incredibly indiscriminate in her behavior.
I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, one of the moments in pop culture that really hit a lot of women to an extraordinary degree was Thelma and Louise, and the kind of, first of all, the kind of revenge taken against the rapist, but then the truck driver in the movie. I mean, it seemed to me that it really hit a nerve, and it really was something that women were very responsive to in the pop culture. It was like a kind of watermark almost, wasn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that kind of revenge fantasy is, I think, something that you know, a lot of women have harbored. And so to see it up there on the screen, so beautifully executed by those actors, was fantastic. Although, of course, you know, they had to die in the end. So there's that punishment by plot thing. So that, I mean, that movie was not, I think it was an incredibly important movie. I still, to this day, really appreciate it, but it's not unalloyedly positive as far as, you know, female agency.
You're right. They had to die. Felicia, join us. Good morning.
Yes. Well, I'm just overwhelmed. I'm an over 50 former, I'm still a feminist, but I haven't heard anyone that I totally agree with on everything, including articulating what has bothered me about popular culture since the backlash against feminism, including your remarks about display and catching a man. And you didn't mention the spike heels. I mean, after we fought so hard for women being able to dress so that it was good for their health and posture, they're back wearing those stupid spike heels. Although I guess flip-flops are kind of an alternate to that now. But anyway, I wanted to know more about the magazine. First of all, your background, are you both academics? You're very articulate. I like the way you express yourself. And where on the peninsula can I get your the compendium of the, what do you call the new?
Bitchfest is the new book. And they're both obviously overeducated young women, very smart and agile with their minds. You want to talk a little bit about your backgrounds, though?
We've just both been to college, no postgraduate education. I think we're both just kind of overly verbal and, you know, into the writing.
And analytical.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, but there's no, people often ask, like, what was your training? And it's kind of like, none, like critical engagement with pop culture. And as far as putting out a magazine, we just learned it all, you know, kind of by the seat of our pants, trial and error with, sadly, sometimes a little emphasis on the error. But, and as far as...
I think I read where you said your biggest response or your biggest mistake was not reaching out to the publishers and not bringing outward help in early on.
Yes, we thought we had to learn to do everything ourselves and didn't get advice from other people when we should have. But, you know, what's done is done. but as far as where to get the book and the magazine, any independent bookstore near you, we really encourage you to seek out your local independent bookstore. And if they don't have it, ask them to order it. You can, of course, also buy it from the usual suspects of those other kinds of bookstores that really should not be patronized unless you absolutely have to.
And I mentioned before, but I'll mention once more, the book release party is tonight at Rickshaw Stop, 155 Fell Street in San Francisco at 7:30. Tickets are $15. We'll go to more of your calls in just a moment. Here's a listener named Vanessa who says, what about Elaine on Seinfeld? Perhaps one example of a non-sexualized female comedian?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the thing. There are always great exceptions, you know, and Elaine is one of them. And there have definitely been women on sitcoms who have always done a fantastic job. I mean, you could, you know, talk about Carol Burnett in the same way. But I think always with especially female comedians in a male ensemble cast like Seinfeld, so much of their humor is really turned on themselves. They really use the kind of female defensive humor that involves sort of pointing out their flaws or magnifying their daily embarrassments. But, you know, I love Elaine.
And I also think that Elaine was somewhat of an anomaly from what Andy was just talking about, because all of the characters were fairly self-deprecating on that show. Well, except Kramer. But, you know, their self-deprecation as a form of humor was across the board on that show, making Elaine really kind of even more of a standout, I think.
Here's a listener named Cheshire who says, I'm frequently annoyed by Deborah Solomon's attitude toward her subjects in her interviews in the New York Times Magazine, and I love it when her interviewees get the best of her. Andy Zeisler's recent interview is a prime example. Congratulations on Bitch's anniversary and the anthology. It's a great magazine. And Jackie from Berkeley writes, I've been reading Bitch since I was in high school. I'm now a graduate student. It was my first real introduction to feminist discourse, and it was a lifesaver. Something I'm curious about is what Lisa and Andy might say about the back matter controversies that have affected the magazine, including a full-page vibrator ad and a financial appeal from Sandra Singh Lowe. Do things like this affect circulation? They certainly appear in the pages of the magazine. You'll have to give us some back story here, because I don't know what she's talking about.
Sure. Well, I'll go in order of what she mentioned. We, back issue number 18, which we're now up to 33, so this was several years ago, we had an ad on the back cover from an organization called Toys in Babeland, which is a really great feminist sex toy shop, and they've been a longtime advertiser. And this particular ad was a little more explicit than others. It was, usually they used illustration, and this ad had a woman's torso, and she was holding a big purple vibrator and kind of pulling up her, like, plastic skirt a little bit. I mean, it was definitely a provocative image. And
objectifying the woman, no doubt.
Well, I mean, you could make that argument.
I think it was really objectifying the vibrator much more.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I mean, you know, it's about
self-pleasure.
But that
was the kind of criticism you got, right?
Actually, no. Oh. We ran afoul of the Postal Service because, you know, section hootie whatever of the, you know, domestic mail manual says that it's obscene and lewd to advertise sexual devices on the outside of a mail piece. Like, it was really, you know, and I mean, yes, we did also get a lot of criticism from readers because some of them were just offended by the image. One person thought the woman's hand looked, quote unquote, masculine, and she was bothered by that, which I found completely bizarre. But some of them were, of course, incredibly reasonable. I think my favorite one was, you know, I really want to pick the moment that I choose to teach my 4-year-old about sex toys, and going to the mailbox is not that moment, you know. And so we really took that to heart, but we also received, you know, a very stern letter from the Postal Service about, you know, what we could and couldn't do. So
you're in violation then, huh?
Yeah.
Ah. And she asked about someone named Sandra.
Sandra Singlo is another radio person who's a really great performer and a supporter of ours. And she recently bought the back cover to use it as a fundraising appeal for us, and which is, you know, sorely needed. We are a nonprofit organization. Our business model, unlike most magazines, we do not rely very much on ads. That's kind of the biggest difference between a magazine like Bitch and a magazine like Glamour. Well, there's a lot of reasons, a lot of differences. But, you know, they make their money off of selling the readers' eyeballs to advertisers, and we really rely on our readers for support because our content is not what's known as advertising-friendly. You know, for obvious reasons. And so, you know, we do a lot of fundraising from our readers, and we use the pages of the magazine that way. And the things that the caller was referring to, there were a lot of letters that were run about both of these incidents. So we use our letter section to discuss a lot of this stuff with our readership, because we want our readers' opinions, and we want them to be able to discuss things with each other and to really, you know, engage with all the stuff that we're writing about. And so that's kind of what went on. And as far as its effect on circulation, which is, I believe, really the original question, I don't think that they affected circulation very much. I think that they're just, you know, they're part of our, like, the robustness of our content. So that obviously supports circulation, but.
Well, we'll circulate some more calls here. Scott, thanks for waiting. You're on. Good morning.
Oh, hi. Just a quick comment. I'm a 4-year-old dad, and I've got a daughter, and I know just the name of the magazine, I wouldn't want my daughter being referred to in that way. And I noticed in pop culture it happens all the time in rap music, pop music, and that sort of thing. And I'll just take my answer off the air, but I'd like you to comment on why would you take a name that I feel is probably someone who's more feminist than most of my friends, that should be kind of excised from our culture. Why would you use that as a name for the magazine?
Well, to some extent, of course, you've explained that already, but I think Scott is raising some concerns here that are legitimate. When you talk about a 4-year-old seeing that ad, you know, a 4-year-old seeing Bitch. Andy?
Well, I think one way to look at it is to, and we like to do this, is to really look at the active verb form of the word and look at Bitch as...
Sorry. Thought I turned it off, yeah.
Think about the action of bitching, which is really about speaking up and objecting to things that that bother you. And so I realize that that's a somewhat disingenuous answer for a father of a 4-year-old who's really worried about the word bitch. But I guess my feeling would be that, you know, maybe better to learn the word from a magazine that can actually start some interesting discussions, maybe not, you know, when the child is 4, but maybe further on down the line, than to have the child really learn the word and identify with it from music or from a movie where all the women are called bitches, or a TV show where men are calling each other bitches, for that matter. I mean, I feel like there's definitely, you know, for all we talk about language reclamation, there's still, the word still has a lot of negative power. But, you know, I think...
It's hard to start a discussion about the negative power of the word with a four-year-old.
Well, yeah, but you know, I think in a few years, maybe the time will be ripe.
Here's another listener says, the antidote, don't provide TV for your kids. Absurd that bitch staff say kids will get media no matter what. You can avoid it.
Well, you can avoid it in your own house, but if you want your kid to socialize with other people, if you don't want to have to micromanage every element of your child's life and, you know, say, oh, if my kid's going to go over to your house for a play date, no TV, you know, I mean, it's really, it is difficult. And also, I mean, if you walk on the street with your kid, you're consuming media. I mean, there's billboards. That's just bottom line. I mean, there really isn't a way to avoid it. Although I do agree with that comment that you can seek to minimize. You know, although I also want to say that can backfire on you. I mean, my parents were very, very strict with the TV, and my sister and I were allowed half an hour a day all when we were growing up. And, you know, what did I want to do as soon as I had enough control over my own life? I wanted to watch as much TV as I possibly could, you know, and now it's my career. So, you know, watch out for that.
Here's Barbara, who says, one thing that really annoys me of how women are portrayed by the media and TV shows is the super professional women that, although they achieve the same recognition as their men peers, they never have a life. They sacrifice everything for their job. That's becoming the stereotype of the working woman, somebody that chooses her profession above everything. See Grey's Anatomy. It's like there can't be any balance between professional passion and having a family. And here's Jennifer, who writes, as the mother of a two-year-old daughter, I'm constantly annoyed by the lack of compelling girl characters on children's programs. Dora the Explorer is always cited as an educational program with a strong girl as the central character. This is true, and I appreciate that. However, Dora is almost the only girl character in the series. Most of the other repeating characters are male, as are most of all the one-time-only characters, and this drives me crazy because it teaches our daughters that strong, engaging girls or women are the exceptions and that most of the people in the world are boys or men. How difficult would it be for the people who write these shows to simply make half of the incidental characters girls? It's not as if the character's gender matters to the simple plot lines. Right, we'll get another caller on here in the meantime. And Diana from Phoenix, Arizona, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I want to congratulate the editors and publishers of Bitch Magazine. I haven't read it that often, but it's been a real support. The other thing I wanted to share is that I'm almost 60 years old. I've been a lawyer for about, oh, gosh, too many years to count. I went to law school in the early 70s, and that was my first experience of being called a bitch. And I decided shortly after I began practicing law that what that really meant was that the other male lawyers calling me a bitch meant that they disagreed with my opinion or my analysis.
Or that you were a strong woman, right?
Well, or they were trying to intimidate me. And I decided from that point on that I would encourage people to call me a bitch, and I would actually treat it as a compliment. So I'm just delighted that you've been on the bookshelves and on the newsstands for 10 years, and just thank you for all your hard work and continuing to raise these very crucial issues for not just our girls' futures, but the future of the planet. And just thank you very much.
And thank you for the call, Diana. It's a very nice call, and certainly validates what you've been all about. And Linda from Berkeley, join us.
Yes, well, I'm another over 60. I was part of the feminist movement, and I want to thank them. I'm really pleased to hear this program. Michael, when I first heard the title, I went, oh, God, you know. And I'm just delighted. I think that what they're doing is wonderful. I would like to say to that concerned father that, boy, he's got a lot more to worry about than the word bitch. He has a lot more vigilance to apply to his child's life, you know, than concerning seeing the word bitch on a cover. Perhaps the content of a person's character or the content of a magazine is more important. And I would just like to ask them a couple of things about, by the way, would you repeat the one rickshaw stop thing? You went rather quickly over that, Michael, before you...
Sorry, the rickshaw stop is at 155 Fell Street in San Francisco.
And what is it?
It's the party for the book tonight, the release party at 7:30 p.m.
Oh, thank you.
That's and a birthday bash for 10 years, and it's $15.
Thank you very much. The other thing was, do these young women have a couple of books they'd like to recommend to those of us who are just climbing on the wagon? And the other thing is something in Doonesbury a few weeks ago where one of the things was, he said, once a social transformation is largely complete, the language that drove it loses both urgency and meaning, referring to feminism. So it's interesting what maybe down the road, when the word bitch has lost some of its urgency and meaning.
Let's see if we can get some recommendations from you on books, because we're getting down to the wire here. And I had one more email I wanted to call attention to.
Yeah. Oh, God, that's hard. I know. I mean, there's so many books. Right now, I am rereading Bell Hooks's Feminist Theory from Margin to Center, which was written in the early to mid-80s or published in the early to mid-80s and is still just so relevant and amazing. I'm loving rereading that.
I wish we could talk about how the feminist movement has tried to bring more women of color in, and to some extent has really not succeeded. I mean, Bell Hooks being obviously a singular example of the opposite, but yeah. But we're going to talk about video games in the next hour, and one listener, we're really almost out of time here, wants to know about how women characters are portrayed in video games. And I know this is probably a whole hour in itself, but has it improved at all? Because we're talking about educational video games, which are really quite positive in some instances.
We actually very recently did an article on this, the sort of problem of game development in terms of female characters. And, you know, I really have to say that that's not something that I am particularly involved in, and I don't pay a huge amount of attention to it. So I'm probably not the best person to answer this question. But
it's a good tease for the next hour.
Yeah.
We'll find out.
I'm very excited to hear it. I hope I get to. But I think that there definitely are a lot more women in game development now who really are focused on the idea of really evolving female characters.
Well, I thank you both for being here. Again, congratulations on your 10-year anniversary. Their collection, Bitch Fest, was released yesterday. The release party will be tonight at Rickshaw Stop in San Francisco, 155 Fell Street. Again, $15 for the nonprofit at 7:30. Thank you both, Lisa Jervis and Andy Zeisler. You've been listening to Forum, and we thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.